This podcast discusses domestic violence, criminal behavior, murder, and adult themes. While not explicit, listener discretion is advised. Our story now returns to where it started, the Woodbine Cemetery and Puyallup, Washington. On December 6th, 2012, Susan's friends and family gathered at the cemetery to mark the third anniversary of her disappearance. A new monument stood at the top of the hill, above Charlie Ann Braden's gravesite. The bronze angel, with outstretched wings and arms, stood atop a large stone block. It was an angel of hope, a reference to the novel The Christmas Box by author Richard Paul Evans.
It's a calm place for me. It feels right that these boys are here because it's so quiet and calm, because when I met them, it wasn't quite that way.
This monument in Puyallup has become a special place to reflect for people who knew Susan, Charlie, or Braden. People like Nancy from the Puyallup Gem and Mineral Club, or Pierce County Sheriff's Detective Sergeant Gary Sanders.
You know, it's one of those bookmarks in your long line of memory that's forever will be there, so periodically, you know, yeah. But pay respects, and the Christmas angel that's out there, and it's a beautiful place. And hopefully they're at peace now.
This is Cold, Episode 18, Angel of Hope. I'm Dave Cawley. Back after this.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
You can power up your playtime with the Nintendo Switch system, the home of Mario and friends. You may discover exciting surprises with Mario, Princess Peach, and more in Super Mario Bros. Wonder. Or challenge friends to a race in Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. You can head to Nintendo.com to learn more about the Nintendo Switch system. Games and systems sold separately.
The sting of loss has never gone away for the people who loved Susan and her boys. Friends like Amber Hardman.
And they're happy boys. Crazy, happy boys, like boys should be, right? We'd show up and they'd always be running around playing, sometimes in their underwear, you know, just crazy boys.
Or Linda Bagley.
One of the biggest things I remember about Susan that was so something to look up to for me was the service she did for others. She's coloring people's hair, cutting people's hair, not charging them. For those that were older, for those that were needed it maybe and didn't have the funds, she did all those things for people, and she did all those things for her family, all the service she did for her family and stuff, and that is something to be admired.
Or Debbie Caldwell.
Charlie liked bugs. He liked to find bugs. He was outdoors, intrigued by things, so he was always looking for things. Now, Braden was all about cars and blocks. As long as I had the cars and blocks, that was great. But Braden actually had quite a little witty personality. He was kind of a teaser. He liked to tease. You could see that in his personality. That was kind of like Susan, too.
Josh's older sister, Jennifer Graves, still grieves for what should have been. Seeing Charlie and Braden grow into bright, happy young men.
The boys' murder wasn't the end. It did
It did close a chapter for me, though, because the single biggest thing that I was concerned about was the boys. I wanted them to get out of that situation and not continue to perpetuate this violent cycle that was continuing through my family. And I wanted them to be able to have a normal, loving family relationship as much as possible.
I've mentioned Jennifer's book, A Light in Dark Places, a few times during this podcast. Jennifer told me that she hoped in writing it, she might inspire women in situations like Susan's to escape.
Part of the motivation for writing my book was trying to instill that courage in others and that recognition of a bad situation and realization that it shouldn't go on. There needs to be a change in that situation, and sometimes it can be corrected. Sometimes with help, people can change and you can fix the situation and end up with a good and positive marriage and family situation. But sometimes it isn't possible. Sometimes the right decision is to get out.
Susan's dad, Chuck Cox, has a similar goal.
I would guess probably around 100 people at least have made differences in their lives to prevent themselves from being caught in that same trap. And that's the reason, the only viable reason for doing it from now on is to let people know about the danger signs that were there.
Now retired Detective Ellis Maxwell has also spent the last few years working on a book.
I thought I would have that thing written in 6 months, but it's tough because I catch myself basically just start working the case again and analyzing this data and analyzing that, and it becomes really taxing. I mean, I'd sit down and I'd start typing, and I'll type and type and type and do this and do that, and then next thing you know, I can't sleep for 2-3 days.
Ellis told me our conversations have helped.
Sitting here and, you know, meeting with you and answering your questions and sharing some insight has been beneficial for me. And it's helped me kind of get through my own struggles from doing it. Because it's always going to be there. It's never going to go away.
But Ellis is just one of many, many people who took part in the Powell investigation. A lot of them still carry the weight of their experiences in private.
Everybody involved in the cases has struggled at one point or another with it. And, you know, because it's really super challenging. And all of them, not just me, are going to have to, you know, answer questions and live with this case for the rest of their lives as well, especially when people learn that how close to the investigation they were.
Of course, a key element of that struggle arises from the absence of answers.
There's answers that I'll never, ever get. And, you know, there'll never be any justice held against anybody for their actions. And, you know, the likelihood of Susan ever being discovered is, in my personal opinion, very super low.
This is the part where I'm supposed to say I've cracked the case, that I've found Susan, that she can at last rest in peace with her boys. I'm sorry. I can't do that. I wish I could. Instead, I'm going to do what reporters are trained not to do. I'm going to share my personal views, what I think likely happened to Susan. But I stress, this is a theory. It's based on evidence and inference, but is ultimately nothing more than an educated guess, one that is subject to change. Here goes. I believe Josh Powell killed Susan. I believe it was a crime he considered for quite some time, likely more than 2 years. I say that because of the steps he took as early as 2007 to obtain life insurance in her name, to establish a trust that would guarantee his access to that money, and to secure power of attorney so he could take legal action in her name. We know from Steve Powell's journals that Josh spoke in 2008 of wanting Susan to have an accident. We know from Susan's handwritten will that she feared Josh would kill her and that he would try to make it appear as though it were an accident. It seems likely that Josh had threatened Susan's life repeatedly. Recognizing that danger, Susan had told an old friend in a November 2008 Facebook message she was ready to make a hasty escape with her sons.
I have friends he would never think of if I need to leave in the middle of the night or whatever. A safe deposit box, docs on file, etc.
Susan had towed right up to the brink of divorce. Her efforts to assert her independence howled around Josh like warning shots over the bow of a ship. He knew what was coming. Josh would not tolerate a divorce. He had seen just how ugly his own parents' split had been. He also viewed Susan as his property and their two sons as extensions of himself. Under no circumstance would he allow her custody of them. For Josh, killing Susan would have seemed to solve two problems. It would have rid him of a wife he no longer wanted, and, if done properly, would have paid his bills for years to come. I'm not sure why December 6th, 2009 was the date he chose to take the final step, but Susan's impending April deadline for divorce seems a probable factor in the decision. As for the act itself, I believe Josh used some sort of drug or substance to incapacitate Susan. I can envision a scenario in which Josh intentionally brake-checked another driver a few months before that December day, causing a crash. We know for a fact that after that fender bender on September 2nd, Josh obtained a prescription for a drug that would do the job, cyclobenzaprine. The script he filled the day of the crash was for 40 pills, enough to last about a week. When police later found the bottle in the Sarah Circle house in December, it still held 32 pills. If Josh had been in such pain from whiplash, wouldn't he have taken more? And how many cyclobenzaprine pills would he have needed to crush up and put into the cream cheese on Susan's pancake, the one he personally prepared for Susan on December 6th, to leave her feeling tired? Susan once mentioned in a Facebook message, Josh did not have a gun.
No weapons, aside from power tools and kitchen knives.
It seems plausible Josh might have used one of his tools, perhaps an electric drill, to kill Susan.
Every tool case, I mean, he's a tool dream guy. It's a Boss Stitch nail gun, a Milwaukee drill, a rigid drill, some type of rigid sander, and a rigid saw.
Josh might have used the rug doctor he'd acquired to steam clean any blood that made it onto the carpet or couch cushions. Perhaps that job took longer than he anticipated. In his rush, he could have missed a spot. The swipe mark of Susan's blood on the upper headrest of the couch. There were also those small drops of Susan's blood on the tile floor next to the couch that he failed to notice, perhaps scattered by a spinning drill bit. It would have also taken time to wrap Susan's body, a necessary step to prevent the spreading of forensic evidence. It's possible he used one of the several tarps he kept in the garage. Maybe he used the tree wrap he had purchased to lightly bind Susan's arms and legs together, leaving no marks or residue, as duct tape might. In this scenario, Josh would have grabbed Susan's cell phone and powered it off, understanding the risk of it being tracked as he moved her body away from the house. But in his rush to clean and dump the body before heading out on his camping trip, which was to be his alibi, he might have overlooked Susan's wallet, purse, and keys. That in and of itself might not have been a big problem in his mind. I believe Josh expected he'd have time to return home and tie up loose ends before himself reporting Susan had not come home from work. He probably didn't account for Debbie Caldwell. Josh didn't like Debbie much. If he'd ever bothered to get to know her, he might have realized she took the well-being of her daycare kids very seriously, that Charlie and Braden's unexplained absence would cause alarm.
He didn't think about the welfare and the well-being of the kids.
It's likely Josh was on his way home to finish cleaning up on the afternoon of December 7th when he took that first phone call from Giovanna Owings. He learned, at that moment, police were already looking for Susan. Worse yet, they had already been in the house.
I still can't figure out how he thought. Leaves me at a loss.
In another phone conversation that afternoon, Josh asked his sister, Jennifer Graves, what she knew.
Just more evidence. More evidence that he had this preconceived plan and was involved in her disappearance.
If he had hidden the murder weapon away until he could return home and dispose of it, he might have feared that police had already found it. So Josh went on the defensive. His plan appeared to hinge on the idea that Susan had gone to work. In order to sell that story, he drove south to Point of the Mountain and called her phone, the one he knew was with him in the minivan, to leave this message.
Anyway, hopefully you got to work okay. And, of course, give me a call. I guess I'm talking about picking you up, but let me know, because if you have plans afterwards or whatever.
Josh then drove north to Salt Lake City and parked outside Susan's work, knowing full well she had not shown up for her shift that day and would not be coming out for a ride home. I place a lot of weight on this. Establishing that Susan had gone to work seemed critical to Josh. He insisted on it from his very first interactions with Detective Ellis Maxwell.
So where would your wife be at? Where would you think she'd be at?
I don't know. I'm just thinking on her way to work, but not for this long.
That insistence leads me to believe Josh intended for Susan's body to be found and for her death to have appeared as either an accident or as a random act of violence, one for which Josh had an alibi. He was in the desert, witnessed by sheep herders, when it happened. Susan being found and her death being someone else's fault would have been necessary if Josh intended to claim the life insurance. In this scenario, Josh would have left Susan's body somewhere near the Wells Fargo call center where she'd worked. Charlie, if he was awake and in the minivan at the time, might have seen an airplane taking off from nearby Salt Lake City International Airport. And that could explain his perplexing comment to police on December 8th about having flown in an airplane to go camping.
How did you guys get to where you were camping?
We got in the airplane, and the airplane went to Dinosaur National Park.
Oh. You went to an airplane yesterday?
Yeah, and our airplane bring us to Dinosaur National Park.
After Josh's first interview with Ellis on the night of the 7th, he'd have returned home still convinced he could make the plan work. His top priority would have been the destruction of the murder weapon. I believe Josh took that weapon, again possibly a power tool, and used his oxyacetylene torch to obliterate it in the garage of the Sarah Circle house. Next, Josh would have sanitized everything. The rug doctor, the minivan, the soiled washcloths he had left in the bathtub. He'd have stayed up all night to do it, even missing his morning appointment with police to make sure he did not miss anything. I believe Josh went into his second interview with Ellis on December 8th, cautious but confident.
She's left your boys. She's left you.
No, I don't think she did.
You don't think so?
No.
Help me. Where should we look
for her? I think she would have gone to work.
Okay.
She would have tried to go to work. Right. I mean, that's what she would have been in the process of doing.
By the end of that interview, Josh would have known the plan, like his wife, was dead. Ellis knew he had killed Susan, but not how. And he didn't have the evidence. When Ellis confronted Josh with Charlie's statement about Susan having gone camping with them, Josh recognized the police did not yet know what had actually happened. Because Susan had not gone out to the West Desert with them. At that point, Josh would have known if he were to survive, the plan had to change. Susan would have to disappear forever. So, on the night of December 8th, Josh obtained the rental car. He drove to the ATM outside of his bank in West Valley and withdrew about $600 in cash. I believe it's plausible Josh could have then returned to where he had originally left Susan's body, retrieved it, and moved it to a place where it would be safe from discovery, somewhere within a slightly less than 400-mile radius of West Valley City, Utah, probably up north in one of the dark stretches of southern Idaho. In that frantic process, he strained his shoulder. During this time frame, Josh told his own father the same story he had told the police. Steve Powell was skeptical, but he had no foreknowledge of the murder and no hand in its execution.
I think we'll find her. I really do.
Over the course of the following weeks and months, Steve concocted an alternate reality in his mind rather than face the horrible truth that his son had murdered the object of his unrequited obsession.
I mean, Josh, I am totally comfortable that he had nothing to do with it.
I believe the only person Josh had confided in was his brother Michael. Michael's phone records suggest he was aware of his brother's plan and, when it went awry, accepted the task of helping Josh manage the mess. I do not believe Michael met Josh on December 8th or 9th while Josh was unaccounted for in the rental car. I do not believe Michael disposed of Susan's body. I say this because Steve Powell's journals describe Michael as being home in Puyallup on those days.
I got the impression that the first day he was expecting her to come back because she occasionally left and sometimes he didn't always know her whereabouts for periods of, you know, a few hours or whatever. And as time went on, I got the impression that he was just getting more and more upset and distraught. By the end of the week, he was in tears. And that's when I remember, because that's when I went down there.
So how do I account for Michael's later paranoia about his Ford Taurus or the cadaver dog hitting on the car's trunk?
You know, I guess you have to wonder, was it purely because of the possible car problems, he wanted to sell the car, or did he just want to get out of the car? Because I remember that when we checked the car out, we couldn't really find that much wrong with the car.
I find it likely that while in Utah, Josh tasked Michael with disposing of some piece of secondary evidence. Perhaps clothing Susan had been wearing when she died, or something similar. Michael might have even been taking that object back to Washington in the Taurus when his car broke down. I can imagine Michael's fear, standing along the side of I-84 between Ontario and Baker City, while in possession of murder evidence, wondering if an Oregon State trooper might at any moment pull up behind him. I can picture Michael flinging whatever that item was into the grass alongside the highway, before limping the car the rest of the way to Baker City. It would then make sense for Josh to stop at that same spot 5 months later and take photographs to ensure whatever it was Michael dumped could not be seen from the interstate. I do not believe Susan's body is in Utah's West Desert. I don't think Josh disposed of her in a mine. So where is she?
Could be in a borrow pit right next to the freeway, somewhere between here and Wendover. Who knows?
After all of this, I can only guess.
You know, son, I have empathy for the Coxes. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, losing a child and, you know, never being able to see them again or put them to rest or not ever have any answers. That would be something I wouldn't wish upon of my worst enemy. It's just horrible.
Find Susan. It remains a hope, a wish, a command, a desperate plea. Final thoughts after this.
If you're like me and refuse to let go of your skinny jeans, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
The question of where to find Susan Powell is no longer the one that most bothers me. To understand why, I need to share something that happened shortly before this podcast first launched. It was October 22nd, 2018, 3 weeks from Cold's debut. I arrived home from work that chilly autumn evening, ready to unwind. In an idle moment, I pulled my phone from my pocket and began scrolling through tweets. I spotted one from the University of Utah. It said, "Alert. Shooting on campus. Secure in place."
We don't believe there's an active threat at this point in time, but we don't have that 100% confirmed.
I called the news director at KSL News Radio, my friend Mark Juke. He was on his way to the station. He had dispatched a reporter to the scene.
The shooting happened earlier today. They did find one person deceased, that victim identified as a woman, and they did identify a suspect as well.
I grabbed my keys, went to my car, and raced back to work.
The situation as it is ongoing at the University of Utah campus this evening, because of a shooting that happened, fatal shooting just around 9 p.m., police are on scene. They are looking for a suspect who has not been located.
We came to learn over the following hours and days that Lauren McCluskey, a student at the university, had been shot and killed outside of her dorm by a man named Melvin Sean Roland.
A couple hours into the investigation, we learned that suspect had gotten off of campus in a vehicle. He was picked up through an investigative lead. Approximately 1:15 in the morning, the suspect was located by Salt Lake City Police Department downtown off of 600 South. A foot pursuit ensued. The suspect ran into a church, at which time he took his own life.
Lauren's and Susan's stories are different, yet they are the same. Both women lost their lives to a romantic partner. Both women had come to Utah from Washington. Susan to escape her father-in-law, Lauren to perfect her talents as a gifted runner.
Lauren was an outstanding student scholar and an accomplished student athlete. And the students, staff, and faculty who knew her are feeling a profound loss.
Melvin had lied to Lauren about his age. Lauren was 21. Melvin was 37. He had also lied about his status as a convicted felon and sex offender on parole. He had served time in prison after raping a teenage girl. One of Lauren's friends had learned Melvin's secret and warned her. That's when Lauren broke off their brief relationship. But Melvin would not leave Lauren alone. He used technology to terrorize. He bombarded Lauren's phone with text messages, using spoofed phone numbers to make it appear as though the texts were coming from Melvin's friends. In fear, Lauren called police for help.
I got a text about, you know, asking if I wanted to go to a funeral, his funeral. And I think they're trying to lure me somewhere.
Yet, Lauren also doubted her own instincts.
Okay, and is there a protective order between you guys, or is he just an ex of yours?
Just an ex.
Okay. And are you trying to avoid him? Or not necessarily?
I would say it's more just his friends.
That changed when, in an email, Melvin threatened to publish intimate photos of Lauren unless she transferred $1,000 to his account. She did. Then, Lauren again contacted police. She just wanted the harassment and extortion to stop.
Do you know when an arrest would be made?
You can talk to an officer if you want. I can arrange that if you want that.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds good.
But Melvin was not arrested. Police failed to piece together his status as a parole violator. A week elapsed before, on the night of October 22nd, he snatched Lauren in the parking lot outside her dorm, dragged her into the back seat of a car, and shot her to death. Lauren was on the phone with her mom when it happened.
My daughter, Lauren McCluskey, was talking to her mom, and then she just started saying, "No, no, 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 no," and it sounded like someone might have been grabbing her or something.
I did not know Lauren, but her death shook me. Lauren McCluskey and Susan Powell should both be alive today, along with many other women who have been killed at the hands of a husband, a boyfriend, a date, a coworker, or even just an acquaintance. So I'm less concerned with the question, "Where is Susan?" than I am the question, "Why does this keep happening?" One particular passage from Susan's emails has resonated with me. She wrote it in November of 2008, a little over a year before her disappearance. She said,
"I'm finding out more and more that family and friends were seeing the red flags long before I did. And of course, I wish they would have said something."
Susan, I make this pledge to you. I resolve to treat the women in my life with respect, compassion, and understanding. I vow to believe any woman who expresses through words or actions a a concern for her safety. I promise to call out and condemn abusive, manipulative, or controlling behavior any time or place I encounter it. And if I ever fail to live up to this standard, I invite those who know me to hold me accountable. We can do better. We can be better. To anyone who is listening, I would be honored if you would join me in making this same commitment. My name is Dave Cawley. Thank you for listening to Cold.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.